Good evening. I'm K2 Kilowatt.
Where's all those clicking sounds coming from? Oh, looks like I got a slightly loose microphone here. K2RIW, Kilo 2 Romeo Indy Whiskey is my call letters. My name is Dick. You'll also hear a Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. And Mel and Dick, I attempt to run this thing called the technical net. We try to be the net control. On this particular occasion, we should hear all kinds of things that happened today. We usually discuss on the tech net subjects mostly of interest to ham radio operators. Well, ham radio operators are interested in a whole lot of things. They're, from my point of view, a real true ham radio operator is kind of a scientist inside who doesn't have the wherewithal to get all the education to become an official scientist, but by way of the experiments we do in our backyard with our antennas, and our transmitters and receivers, and fox hunting and whatever, we do study wireless technology and enjoy it. Some of us live it and breathe it. So on this TechNet, these guys come together and share information. This is an primarily educational, association, and a little bit of entertainment sneaks in from time to time. Most of the time, the subjects that we discuss on the TechNet are the subjects that you bring as questions. Rarely do we have a package of material that we present. Once in a while, Mel does present a package on something like how does a Smith chart work, or how do decibels work, or how do you do impedance matching, things like that, on occasion. But most of the time, it's what you ask. You guys decide the subject. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, try to remember to give me your name, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. And as you sign in during that first hour in the beginning, we make a promise that we try very hard to answer everybody's question within that first hour, at least as a brief answer. So you don't have to wait for more than an hour, from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, to get at least a partial answer to your particular question. After 9 o'clock, Mel goes to his mailbag where the new people entering ham radio send him emails and snail mails with their further questions, because the majority of what we do on the technical net is a live question and answer period. We're not promising that the tech net is going to serve as a written consulting service free of charge. We're not offering that. But for the new people who are getting into ham radio and don't have a license yet and can't get on and ask their question directly, we do provide a method for that. After the mailbag, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what's going on. And there's a new satellite that's been launched, or a pair of satellites called the Grail, I think it is. I think we're going to be hearing about those. And I'm starting to see reports of ham radio operators are tooling up their equipment so that they can listen to the microwave signal coming from this lunar orbiting satellite directly on their own, somewhat like a few people who listen to the Apollo astronauts, for instance, with backyard equipment. So the Grail satellite, there are ham radio operators tooling up right now to listen to that direct signal. Let me drop. Okay, what else was I going to tell you guys? That's more than enough. So give me your call letters and the name and the yes right now if you do have a question or a comment for the technical net. You need not sign in if you're just listening. After 29 years, September of 1982 is when the TechNet first began. This is the 29th year. After 29 years, we believe there are people in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, listening. It doesn't have to be proved to us anymore. Although sometimes it does get pretty quiet and we're not sure. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2OSR, Bob, and yes, Dick.
WK2J, John, yes.
WHOYY, Joe, yes.
Okay, so we got three of them so far. Bob, John, and Joe in that order. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now.
November 1, Mike Golf, Mark near Danbury, yes.
Wendy, no.
Hey, the man in Danbury, Mark, November 1, give me those call letters again.
November 1, Mexico, Germany, near. How you doing?
Okay. We got you, Mark, near Danbury. Let me think. 1, 2, 3, you're number 4. Okay. And I heard into Mike Bravo, Moonbounce. With very low audio, Barry, so you might want to correct that. And there was an extremely weak signal in there that I didn't hear. Want to try again? Give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. That signal was 97% noise. And give it one more try. I'll listen very carefully. Give me the call letters a couple of times in a row. Barely tell there's a human voice in there. The audio is too low. The RF is extremely weak. So, if you give me a little more audio and do something to increase the RF, we'll try again a little bit later. Okay, let's start off right now with Bob, W2OSR. How are things with you? And were you without electricity at all during Hurricane Irene? You got it, Bob.
And Dick Bob, Space Report latest, Paul WS2M.
Glad to hear that, Paul. You got it, Bob.
Okay, well, thank you. This is Bob, W2OSR. Yeah, Dick, I was without power for a short period of time. Someone loaned me a generator. I just about got the generator hooked up to get a few things running, and the power came back on. Let me let this recycle, and I'll come back in here with my question. Okay. I think I told you that I've put up a new set of antennas here at the house. I've got a stack now with a UHF and two VHF antennas. But what I noticed during the VHF contest this weekend is that I'm getting bleed through from my 6-meter transmitter into my 2-meter receiver. So I'm just trying to find out where I might be able to locate a high pass filter that I could put in line with the 2-meter transceiver to eliminate that problem.
Yeah, there are designs that I've seen from time to time on filters, although a 2-meter high-pass filter, that's not a very difficult thing. There's a chance you'll find something close to what you're looking for in the radio amateur's handbook, a chance. And if you Google those words, I know you're going to find various ways of building a filter with inductors, capacitors, or with comb lines and other kinds of resonators. However, what's the brand name of the 6-meter transmitter? What's the brand name of the 2-meter receiver? Are we absolutely sure that there aren't higher harmonics coming out of the 6-meter transmitter? If the 6-meter transmitter is making a third harmonic on 150 megacycles and it's doing it strong enough and it's close enough to your 2-meter equipment, even with the high-pass filter, you could still be getting some grief. So if you took your 6-meter transmitter and brought it to Andy, WA2CDL, and he looked at it with his service monitor running in the spectrum analyzer mode, and you find out how many decibels down is the second and third harmonic of your 6-meter transmitter when it goes into a good dummy load, that would be a good thing to know, because I've heard of cases like this where a person puts in a nearly perfect filter and still has a problem. Also, you got to worry about are the two rigs running from the same 12-volt power supply and they're wired together and they're talking to each other through the 12 volts, and do you have real tight coaxial connectors that are well shielded, and there's no stray braid on the coax connector not making good grounding. There's a lot of things involved here. And I presume the 2-meter antenna and the 6-meter antenna are stacked on the exact same mast. Over to you, Bob, for some of those questions and answers. The first, W2OSR, K2RIW.
All right, Dick. Let's start with the easy one first. Yes, the antennas are stacked on the same mast. There's about 3 to 4 feet distance between the 2 and the 6-meter antennas. So they're fairly close to each other, and I think that's part of the problem. As far as the rigs are concerned, I'm using a Yaesu FT950, I bought it new this year, so it's a fairly new piece of equipment, and that's what's being used for 6 meters. For the transceiver that I'm using for the 2 meter 440, it's an ICOM 910. Also a fairly good piece of equipment from what I've been able to tell from the reviews.
Okay, good, good pieces of equipment, and that helps an awful lot. Bear in mind now that when the transmitter and receiver, or let me pick a number, the transmitting receiver and antenna are 3 feet apart, 4 feet apart, extremely close coupling where you're getting a 20 dB of free space loss between the two, and that's all. And your transmitter, if your transmitter on 6 meter was running, let me pick a number, 100 watts, that would be plus 50 decibels, 50 dBm. A good 2 meter receiver can easily receive a signal of minus 100 dBm. So you have 150 decibels of power spread between your transmitter and your receiver. In other words, in theory, if a signal, 140 decibels weaker, coming out of your 6 meter transmitter, happened to be on the 2 meter frequency, the 2 meter receiver would respond to it. Because the usual specification for a FCC approved transmitter is 60 decibels of suppression or more of all undesired harmonics, and you've got 150 decibels of power spread, you can see how the numbers don't come out so favorably. One of the first things you'd like to know is, where is the sneak pass? Let me drop. Where is the sneak pass by which the 6 meter transmitter is getting into the 2 meter receiver? If, for instance, you took the output of the 6 meter transmitter and ran it into a dummy load, you didn't run it into the antenna, and you transmit on 6 meters while listening on two with the normal antenna in the normal mode, is it clean? If not, and the first thing you're finding out by doing that test would be that it's not the antennas talking to each other. It's happening right in the shack. And that makes an entirely different method of research, in which case a filter going to the antenna might not do it, if you know what I mean. So the dummy load test is one of the first things I would do. And if you pass that, the passing would be into a dummy load, no problem. Into the antenna, you got the problem. That strongly suggests that it's either the transmission line going to the antenna or the antenna itself radiating the offending signal. And I'm a little bit curious, Bob. Many people, when they transmit on one band, don't necessarily have to receive on the other band, particularly during a contest where cross-banding is okay to set up a QSO, but cross-banding cannot be used itself during the actual contact that gives you the point, if you know what I mean. So is it because of Oscar work that you want to be able to... Oh, wait a minute. Oscar's not on 6 meters, to my knowledge. I'm wondering, what is the requirement? It would be nice to always be able to transmit in any combination and nothing desensitizes anything else, but I'm a little curious as to why you would like to be able to transmit on 6 meters while listening on 2 meters. Interesting question you got there, Bob. W2OSR, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, what I noticed is that when I was making my contacts on 6 meters, I could hear something coming out of the speaker on the 910, which was monitoring 2 meters. And I'm just a little worried that, you know, with 100 watts not that far away from the 2 meter antenna, I want to make sure that I'm not going to get enough power into the front end of the rig, so I'm going to wind up doing some damage.
That's very unlikely, Bob. It's a good thing to worry about, but I think you're worrying unnecessarily. 100 watts and 5 foot of spacing, we could do the calculation. If the other antenna doing the receiving was also on 6 meters, it would be getting a signal that's 20 dB weaker just because of the free space and the fact that they're side by side, not aimed at each other nose to nose. But where you've got a significant frequency difference, 50 megacycles in one antenna and 146 megacycles, 144 megacycles on the other, it's almost no way you could get enough 6 meter energy into the 2 meter antenna to be above the threshold of damage. Modern day rigs can take probably at least a watt going in on almost any frequency before any damage occurs. So, and by the way, by simple, if you had some kind of a power meter, and you put the power meter on the 2-meter antenna, while slowly sneaking up on the 6-meter power output, you could measure the amount of power coming down the 2-meter antenna when the 6-meter transmitter was going on. The reason I'm telling you to go up slowly is because if your watt meter is only good, if it's a Hewlett-Packard thermistor type watt meter where you're not supposed to exceed plus 20 dBm, 200 milliwatts into that element without burning it out. For that reason, you want to slowly sneak up on the power. So there's a bunch of measurements you can make with a crystal detector, with a spectrum analyzer, whatever. You could measure by various means, by slowly sneaking up on the 6-meter transmitter while putting instrumentation of any kind on the 2-meter antenna. You could find out exactly how much power is getting there and what frequency it's on. And that would also be very nice to know. But with that dummy load test, we'll find out, is it happening through the antenna, or is it happening through the power, the common power supply, and other kinds of wiring within the shack itself? So does that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
So did that part of what I said make some sense, Bob? And by the way, I'd like to be able to hear from you when you make these measurements, what you actually discover. W2OSR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, Dick. You gave me some things to think about and some tests to try here in the chat. By the way, if you're listening on reverse, I'm just curious how you're hearing me because I've got my beam aimed right at you.
My needle is pegged, and if I plug in the attenuator, give me another brief transmission.
Okay. We'll do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, you pegged my meter, so you're giving me a lot of steam. No sweat. And it comes down off the peg when I plug in 20 dB of attenuation on the Kenwood TS711A that I'm using. So you're putting out a healthy amount of steam there, Bob. Is that what you wanted to know? And by the way, when you're aimed at the repeater, and I'm listening to the back lobes of your antenna, you're still giving me a potent signal. And I think you're in the Port Washington area. Is that true?
A little bit to the east of Port Washington. I'm in Glencoe. Now, I've boresighted my antenna on you. It's a 7-element Force 12 beam. I would expect it to hit you pretty hard tonight. All right, Dick. Thanks. Why don't you pick up somebody else, W2OSR.
And I presume that beam is vertically polarized, and did you mount that to the mast itself with the vertical polarization? Over to you, Bob.
No, actually it's horizontally polarized.
Oh. In which case, because I'm slant 45 degree polarized, I'm only 3 dB down, and you're giving me a lot of steam. Okay, the next person who signed in was John, and I didn't write John's call letters down correctly. K2J or something like that. You know who you are, John. Give me your call letters and right ahead with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
How's it going, Richard? WK2J, John. My question is shifted over to the 9/11. Today's 9/11, so I have a question. There are people who are very credible with great educations, architects, engineers, stating on YouTube that 9/11 was an inside job. One of the things they talk about is thermite weakening the steel. They believe it was placed there somehow and that security was compromised. They also state that it's not scientifically possible for jet engine to heat the metal enough to collapse the building, and that was never done before, and it's scientifically impossible for that to be done. Would you agree that it wouldn't be scientifically possible? And is there some question in your mind that 9/11 was an inside job? Over to you, Dick. WK2J.
Okay, I'm waiting for the beep. I'm just going to... concrete has roughly 150 pounds per cubic foot. Each one of the floors had concrete stacked on top of metal, poured concrete, which gave you the stiffness of the floor to make the floor feel stable and to give you lots of soundproofing between the floors. You go 150 pounds per cubic foot, and you go something like 200 foot, 210 foot horizontally and vertically. In other words, the width and length of each floor was roughly 200 and some odd feet. Roughly 1 acre is the footprint of that building. You go through the mathematics of that. You have 500,000 pounds of concrete on each and every floor of the 110 floors of that building. Just the concrete alone in that building was close to 500,000,000 pounds. And yeah, you've got steel trying to hold all of that up. And from my point of view, that building had a marginal design by modern-day standards. It had inadequate fire escapes and whatever. But just the sheer weight of the concrete, you add to that, I don't know the exact number, maybe it's 50,000 pounds of aviation fuel, because the airplane was ready to go to California. It had only gone a short distance before it hit the building. You got something like 50,000 pounds of aviation fuel dumped into that building, and it's burning. The majority of what burned in that building is the flammable materials in the building itself. The building was just filled up with wooden desks and chairs and file cabinets and paper in all of those drawers, lots and lots of paper. So all you need is for the aviation fuel, the airplane to create a whole lot of structural damage, the aviation fuel to create a whole lot of short-term heat, but enough intense heat to light up all the other flammable materials in the building, and a compromised sprinkler system which wasn't able to put out the fire because of all the damage and insufficient water to do that. I'm not even sure it had much of a sprinkler system. So you had more than enough heat being generated to compromise the strength of the steel. When you've got those kind of temperatures and those kind of people bailing out of the building because they can't tolerate the temperature, that weakens the steel and creates the collapse of the building. So the airplane itself has more than enough energy to do all this. So I don't accept that. I know there's lots of websites running around right now, people saying that it was an inside job, and that there's even one website saying that a ham radio operator or a security person with a handy talkie created some kind of false alarming of explosives that were in the building. And by the way, how would you get those explosives in the building? How would you get it past security, if you know what I mean? How would you get it properly installed in all the critical beams? I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think it's a real long shot. And did they do it exactly the same on both buildings? I mean, the failure mechanism of both buildings, with that aviation fuel creating all of that heat, creating all of the flammable material starting to burn, there's more than enough mechanism there for failure with just the airplane. And so,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So as you can tell, John, I'm very skeptical. Not impossible, but there's darn many individual requirements. The building itself had more than enough failure mechanisms because of this particular event. The building was built to be able to tolerate the physical impact of a 707, but not a fully loaded fuel load of something bigger than a 707 crashing in at the... by the way, the terrorist pilot gunned the engine right at the end. He went to full blast on the engine to hit the building as fast as he possibly could, and really, you know, sifted all of that fuel and all of those materials through that building and created a tremendous amount of local heat. Do you remember when you saw the photograph of the second building being hit and you saw all that flame shooting out the other side of the building? Just the stuff that sifted through and managed to go out the far wall and create a fireball. And a hell of a lot of all of that aviation fuel remained in that building and burned and set everything else on fire. So, as you can tell, I doubt it. You're always going to find people who come up with an alternate theory. But I think it's a long shot. You know my opinion, John. Let's see, if anyone else got an opinion on this one before I pass it back to John, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2AMZ. Mike.
Sorry, you're good.
OK,
Okay, we got Mike and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Mike.
KD2AMZ, well, I was there when the second tower was hit. I was standing in the alleyway between World 7 and 140 West Street, and the heat felt like a Las Vegas casino, and during midday when you walk out, the blast of heat was tremendous. So, yeah, there was definitely enough heat energy in there to cause the steel to fail. I personally felt that heat.
And it doesn't even require the fuel to do that. All you need is for enough heat of the fuel to start all of the other flammable materials in that building burning. And now you've got a sustained fire with no real protection of that building, so to speak. And by the way, as that airplane at high velocity when drifting through that building, even the asbestos that was coated onto the steel is all being peeled away. So the building is creating a lot of heat, has no protection from the heat, and the steel is being compromised, and the mass of concrete is just huge. All you need is for one single flaw of a building of that method of construction to collapse onto the next floor below it, 10 or 15 feet down. The total kinetic energy that it creates, half a million pounds of concrete coming down 15 feet, striking another floor, that impact, that impulse, that momentum, starts a pancaking action. And there was a building in Connecticut 15 or so years ago where during construction somebody did something wrong on one of the upper floors as they were pouring concrete, and that floor came down and hit the next floor below it, and the whole darn building collapsed. So that method of building failure, when just one floor of concrete comes down on the next one, is almost assured. And therefore, I don't think that method of construction should be used anymore. Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Deck WS2N.
Paul, you're going to be after Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Oh, well, I'm close enough. No, Vic, I spent many days and weeks and months going around the inside of that building, and I'll just tell you this much, that anybody that thinks that they could actually gain access to certain areas which would be required to put any kind of permit is absolutely out of their mind. The building is was an interesting structure in terms of its internal. And to reach certain parts of it, which would have been required if you wanted to make something happen from the inside, was literally impossible. There's just no way that anybody could do that. It's just that simple. K2RWK,
yes, I remember, Eric, Channel 13 Public Broadcasting System had a major installation on the top of World Trade Number 1 with that 330-foot mast on top. So one of those antennas you were feeding with transmitters that are on, I'm going to guess, the 89th or the 110th floor. You're going to tell us which floor it was. In fact, I think Bill Baker told me you had to go through the back of the cafeteria to get to the transmitter itself, which I guess means that it was on the 110th floor. Give us a few words about the actual access to your transmitter that was in that building. You as the Chief Electronic Engineer for Channel 13. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Actually, you wound up taking three elevators. You took the big elevator to the main 44th floor where the Port Authority was. Actually, in the north tower, that floor was actually an additional 6 feet. There's a long story that goes with that. The north tower is slightly larger than the south tower. I took another elevator up to Windows on the World. And you went through the back of Windows on the World, you get the 99 car, which will take you up to the 110th floor. And actually, I had a hole in the ceiling that you could go straight to the roof. My piece of coax actually went through the side of the building to combine a room. It was married with Channel 9 and Channel 11. And then it went up to the main mast, which was built by RCA, and you can actually climb up the inside of that mast. It was a lot of fun.
When I watch PBS television and I watch the intermission material, that's, in other words, Most of your programs will end at the, say, the 53rd minute of the hour, and there's another 7 minutes to be filled up before the beginning of the next hour and the next program. And quite often you will see a scene that looks like one of those rest floors, as I call it. In other words, one third of the way up the building and two thirds of the way up the building, you would climb out of one elevator, go to a great big a visibility deck with these extra high windows where you get a beautiful view out to the world before you take the next elevator. Those pictures that I see during intermission, are those observation decks at the one-third and the two-third altitude of that building? Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, KQRIW, KE2EJ. Actually, the first step off the big elevator is really sort of like a bus stop. It's where all the elevator banks are. And, yeah, those are big windows that are there, and you get a beautiful view of the city no matter which corner of the building you looked at. And by the way, the footprint at that floor is the same footprint as it is on the roof. So, you know, the building didn't taper, it stayed the same width from the bottom of the top.
And I think the building was something like 210, 205 foot on a side. Is that true?
You can look up the actual number of feet. I don't actually remember what the number is, but it was big. You know, you go up on a roof and look down over the side and actually see the helicopters below you.
I bet you've been up there during some pretty wild pieces of weather. Tell me what kind of weather you've seen on top of there, Eric. Lightning, rain that goes up the side of the building, snow on top of the building, which is rain down at the bottom. Give us some ideas of what you've seen when you're 100 and, let me think now, you were probably 1,300 feet above the street when you're on the roof of that building. Tell us what kind of weather you've seen up there from time to time, Eric, go ahead.
You get a bit of everything, but the one most memorable thing is that when they turn the lights on the mast, there's these finches that actually fly into the mast and smack their heads into it. Hit the ground. But yeah, I mean, that tick gets hit by lightning on a regular basis. And when there's nasty weather up there, we tend not to go up to the roof. It's not really a good place to be. It gets very windy. It gets very wet, very rainy. Sometimes you see the rain go up instead of down. It was an interesting place to be. You could be, during really bad weather, you could be in the bathroom on the 10th floor and look in the toilet bowl and watch the water swish around as the building sways left and right.
Wow. When you're inside the building during a lightning strike of the building itself, did you experience any kind of effect inside the building, Eric?
Other than a faint boom, because, you know, it's pretty soundproof. Although if you were by the door to the roof in that shaftway, you could hear it really well. You could also feel the decompression that goes on.
Sounds exciting. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Oh, by the way, Dick, I'm on my way up here to Glen Oak, so I'm going to interrupt you guys in about 10, 15 minutes to change the board.
WCYK.
When you do interrupt us, it'll be for what length of time, Eric?
Should be more than 3 or 4 minutes.
Bob recognized, but Paul was next. WS2N, go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, Dick, the Connecticut building, they were pre-stressed concrete floors. That was the problem with those. And, unlike the World Trade Center and other buildings where they'll actually pour the cement onto the floor, into the rebar and all that's already there, floor by floor. These things are then done down, in a factory somewhere. They're shipped in, and it's really cables, big cables that are stressed, and then concrete poured around them, and they really wind up like gigantic planks. They call them pre-stressed concrete, and then they cut them off, and if you were to look at the end, you'd see the cable, the end of the cables, it have a whole series of them through each plank. And when they were being set, problem is with it, well, with that building, I think they did have a fire and they had problems, and you know, all it takes is one side to let go. And the end result is the same. All the concrete weight comes down, and it's the same as a regular building. And you're going to have that same, you know, half a million pounds, whatever it is, per floor come down, one right after the other, whether it's pre-stressed or not. But the anchoring problem was the problem. I saw it in Great Neck. I saw it let go. Let me drop it. Doing a building in the garage area was being built like that with this pre-stressed concrete. And nobody got hurt this time. It was, I think, went about five floors down, and one right after the other. One of the planks got away from the iron workers. You know, they pulled the beams apart to put the next upper piece in. I think the one below them got loose that they had done before that. And all it took was, you know, one to drop, and it took out the four below right into the I think they had two levels below the building. Nobody was around there, but, you know, it's not a good system. They still use it, I believe, today, though. It's called pre-stressed concrete.
Yeah, these kind of hammers that they use for hammering a pile into the ground is not too different than what happens when a floor of concrete descends 10 or 15 feet and hits the next floor. The instantaneous force that's created during that impact is almost uncalculatable. You can calculate the amount of momentum that has been converted, but you cannot calculate the instantaneous force. It's a huge number. It's almost a so-called singularity. Bob, WQCYK, I think was the next person who signed in with a question or a comment. Where were you on 9/11? You got it, Bob.
Hold on.
Oh, jeepers, Dick. Good evening. Good evening to the net. Well, 9/11, I was working in the Suffolk County buildings at the Department of Labor in the computer room, and we were immediately evacuated. But years ago, I worked for IBM. Around 1990, I had a desk at the Port Authority on the 74th floor on the South Tower facing south. And I was working on the design of EasyPass at the time. And, you know, those floors are wide open. There's not a lot of structure in them. You know, all the structure's in the outside skin. There's not a lot of columns in the middle of the floor. So, you know, not a lot of structure there. It was just an accident waiting to happen. You know, I'm sure they never expected this much devastation, but, you know, more than once I thought about how could this possibly be standing? There really was no structure. Very interesting. And of course, I've had the daymares, because I would lean to my left and I could look out the window and see south and, you know, out onto the, into the harbor. And, I've often had daymares about looking out the window and seeing a plane coming at my face. This is W2CYK Mobile.
Interesting, Bob. So you had quite an experience there. Your particular occupation on the 74th floor was completed before 9/11, so that's one of the reasons why you were not there, Bob. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, 11 years before, but, yeah, we were done along. My job was done long before that, so. But it was certainly an interesting project. Certainly interesting to work in the towers. I wasn't there all the time. It was just, you know, basically had a desk for meeting prep and if I was working on something specifically with the Port Authority team. But very interesting being there in the building. Having an opportunity to work in the building, certainly to work with the Port Authority.
Now, when it comes to EasyPass itself, which is a kind of RFID system, radio frequency identification, the actual unit that gets mounted to the windshield of the automobile, I believe, is a so-called passive battery-operated or battery-assisted passive RFID. In other words, there's no active transmitter, to my knowledge. Thus, the battery increases the sensitivity of the receiver. When the receiver is interrogated, it spits back a code saying, this is car number 54, so to speak. Is that approximately, I'm speculating here and asking for your confirmation here, Bob. Over to you, Bob.
Well, it's an interesting deviation from the topic. But, originally they were passive, completely passive. And it was basically the pressure of the electrons on the receive antenna would, you know, kind of like a crystal detector would work, you know. And then would, you know, continue pushing the electrons out the transmitting side. And they didn't have to send a lot. That's a tag number and at a very low level. And they had those high gain antennas, of course, above the lanes. So, but now I believe, and I've been out of the loop, but I heard that they switched over to active tags, that the tags that we use today are actually battery assisted, as you put it.
And I'm fairly sure that the battery assist is on the receive function only. There is no active transmitter on board. That what the tag does is to receive the interrogation signal, verify it, and then it spits back its code by modulating the antenna impedance, which modulates the effective radar cross-section of the receiving slash transmitting antenna. And so that variable reflectance signal is what the interrogator at the toll booth reads, and it reads your number. And the modern-day RFID tag can have as much as 120 bits of information. I'm guessing EasyPass doesn't need anywhere near that many. Probably the older style of 96 bits or whatever. It's a very nice system, and you're going to be hearing more and more about that. They're going to be augmenting barcodes. There was another person that was signing in. Who was that? K2RIW?
K2GJE, Ed.
K2GJE. Go right ahead, Ed.
Just wanted to add one more comment in reference to the construction at the World Trade Center. The outside skeleton of those buildings were load-bearing, where in most buildings the outside skeleton is just to button up the building to make it airtight and warm, etc. Also, when the plane went in, it caused at the point of entry to disconnect the floor from the outer supporting member. Also, the heat caused the beams in the floor to warp, and the end result we all know. Back to Ned.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. I've seen a number of cross-sections of the method of construction of the building. There were some support buildings, support columns in the very center, but the majority of the perimeter wall was load-bearing. And those L-brackets that went between the floor beams and the vertical columns of the perimeter of the building, boy, they don't look adequate. When you see the bent-up sheet metal after the event is over, and you see all those failed L-brackets, they look like they didn't have anywhere near enough steel or a big enough bolt to them. So the good news about the building is that each one of the floors was close to a acre of effective area. There was very little columns anywhere except the dead center of the building and the perimeter of the building. It was a very efficient building from that point of view, but it has these built-in failure mechanisms, and when the plane penetrates that outer wall, which was a major portion of the vertical support structure that compromised everything above it, which had a strong tendency to collapse into that missing hole, if you know what I mean.
Hey, Dick.
Go right ahead there, Eric.
This evening, Nova went through the whole mechanical design of the building, so if you catch it, you can see it.
And a person who goes to pbs.org can play back that Nova on his computer. Is that true, Eric?
That's correct.
So we all have access to it, even if we don't see it fly. Yeah, there was a very nice Nova documentary about the construction of the building. So you can see our feelings on this one, John. WK2J, interesting question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, WK2J. All right, that was good. But the thing is, we didn't say that was in heat. We saying that we witnessed testimony from engineers and scientists stating that the heat went up past what a engine fuel would heat up to, which is somewhere around 1900 degrees, and you need about 3000 degrees to compromise the steel. Okay, so if we move on to building number 7, which had no hit and there was no damage to the infrastructure of the building, how did that come down? Over to you, Dick, WK2J.
By the way, when you have this updraft that goes naturally through the building, something that burns at 1900 will go up to about 5000 degrees.
Common.
Yeah, you got a chimney there. John recognized. First of all, you said that the steel was not compromised until 3000 degrees. Steel at 3000 degrees is almost red hot. It's almost flowing. You bring steel up to 1500 degrees, you have nowhere near as much of the original strength that you would have at room temperature. It's definitely being compromised. And some of that steel was being heavily stressed by the fact that there were a tremendous number of missing vertical columns after that impact. How the other building collapsed, I'm not sure. John, I know you want to make a comment. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2MDP.
Steve recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Dick, good evening. I just wanted to point out the structural steel starts to be compromised at anywhere above 500 degrees, by the way.
Yeah, there's a whole curve of weakening versus temperature. Steel, as you start raising the temperature, you get less and less strength of the steel. Go ahead, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
K2. Okay, good evening, Dick. Everyone else on the net. From the documentary I saw, I'm not sure if it was Nova or not, is basically what happened. It wasn't the structural skeleton that was really compromised. It was the steel trusses in the cement floor. In other words, what happened is the steel trusses, the heat from those damaged the steel trusses, which pulled away from the skeleton of the building and allowed the concrete floors to drop. That's what I understand what made that building collapse. Back to you, Dave.
I think we can say, Steve, that all of the above is taking place. The individual beams on the floors holding up half a million pounds of concrete, they're deflecting downward, bending like a bow, pulling away from the wall. The wall itself, which supplies the major vertical support, was compromised because an airplane had just penetrated a whole lot of those columns and sheared them. The columns themselves, if you look at the method of construction, they're a little bit like Legos. They telescope into each other, and there were no bolts across that telescoping. So as you fold an airplane into those vertical columns, those individual telescope sections stop coming apart, and they did. So a huge percentage of the north wall of building number 1 was compromised by the penetration of that airplane. I'm a bit amazed that an aluminum airplane can have that much penetration of steel, but that airplane was probably moving 600 miles an hour at the point of impact. So that's a lot of kinetic energy. The airplane itself is probably close to half a million pounds, moving at 600 miles an hour. You can calculate how much kinetic energy and momentum that has. It's huge. And so it's striking something called a steel. It's striking a steel vertical wall that is not made to have anywhere near the give that would be required to absorb that amount of momentum. Was there someone else that want to make a comment on this one?
KC2WBD.
Yeah, and 2MB, I have a question.
Okay, the previous person, there's something very unusual about your voice. It's almost unreadable. Want to try one more time with your call letters said slowly and maybe with phonetics?
I will try it again. Kilo Charlie 2, Whiskey Bravo Delta, Island Park. Little comment on your subject.
Okay, Whiskey Bravo Delta, go right ahead.
I, as a firefighter, number 1, just want to point out, you got to remember, too, the planes had full fuel load. That's for starters. 2, when it did strike the tower, You got to remember now, you got all that jet fuel, fueling everything in sight. And three, they didn't really say what it was, but in my aspect, I would say that, you know, the rivets and bolts let loose before anything else due to the high heat and fire load in those floors at the time of that crash.
Quite possibly true. Barry, N2MB, where were you during that event? And go right ahead with your comment. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, where was I? I was in Broad Channel, actually. And I actually saw the event. I stopped at I stopped at a friend's house who has his house on the water, and he has a deck out the back, and we just went in, and I said, I got to see what's going on. So we all set up our binoculars and everything on his back porch and kind of watched the entire event play out. So I was in an interesting spot to see it. I wasn't close. I think I'm about 18 miles from Twin Towers at that point. But we saw quite a bit. He had a telescope and binoculars and really beautiful cameras. The guy's a camera buff, so we took a lot of pictures of it when it was happening. My question is, the new structure that's going up, I understand it's very different construction. It has a center core concrete. But does anybody know what they've done with the new structure to possibly prevent something like this happening again? And 2MB.
Yeah, Don, good question. Does anybody have enough information about the Freedom Tower, as it's sometimes being called, the new construction? How much does it differ from the old? I do know that the old structure, World Trade 1 and 2, the Port Authority, which was in charge of its construction, I believe, or the owner or the manager, whatever, was given all kinds of permission to violate normal fire codes of New York City. The fire escape mechanism was not up to code. The sprinkler system may not have been up to code, and so on. So there were a number of compromises that were made that during this event were partial causes of some further grief. So who knows anything about the new building and to how much safer it might be? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, they specifically have developed a new concrete that's especially for reinforcing the floors. This concrete will stand more than double the strength of the concrete that was used in the World Trade Center. And I'll tell you something. I was there previously. I did work there a couple of years before that. And I'll never forget those batteries that we put in for Hansa Fitzgerald for backup due to a blackout. Those batteries were so heavy and so huge that they had to cut into the ends of the wall and put supports in for the batteries to sit on these for the shells, these huge, humongous-sized wet cell batteries, Dick. And I always think about those batteries coming loose, and it's just a horror just to think about them over.
Interesting. I think you're telling me that you were adding additional L-brackets connecting a floor joist to the vertical walls, the outer walls, additional L-brackets and additional bolts. I guess you were putting some kind of blind fastener into those vertical steel columns. And Cantor Fitzgerald, I think, was on like the 80th floor, 79th floor, in that order. And I think that was the North Tower, building number one. And so you were putting in tremendous amount of weight. And thank goodness they were going over to the wall itself with all that extra weight. Otherwise, I presume those backup batteries for Cantor Fitzgerald were drastically exceeding the rated floor loading. Is that true, Eric? FML, K2KEY, K2RIW?
We didn't do the battery installation. Our job was to have the surveillance system to see who comes and goes into the battery room.
because it was a strategic, because previous time when the power went down, when we had the blackout in the city, they were out of business for days until they could get their computer system running. So they wanted a lot of security on that battery room. And so I was there after the batteries. Everything was just about complete. We were putting in the surveillance system, and I looked how they bracketed everything, actually cut into the walls and bracketed to the corners. And they had these huge frames, these huge iron frames that the battery sat on that were about 2.5-3 feet high. And these batteries were huge, made out of like plastic with hydrometers built into the side of them. God knows how many, you know, amperes they were rated at. But they were just monsters. And the first thing came into my mind was those batteries breaking loose and get over.
I wonder why they didn't just use generators to get the batteries.
Good guess. You do get a lot more energy density out of petroleum running a generator. But how are you going to get the petroleum up 80 floors? And how are you going to put a petroleum tank inside of a building? Oh, I mean, Port Authority had a lot of juice, so to speak, to violate normal fire law, but I don't think they could go that far. So yes, you'd get a lot more energy density with fuel if it was legal. Mel, make me a rough guess. You've looked at those batteries. Make me a guess as to their volume. Well, those batteries, if they were all stacked together tightly, would they be 30 foot long, 30 foot wide, 6 feet high? You know, give me some rough guesses as to the total volume of those batteries if they were packed tightly together. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, this is Dick. Time to make a break.
I didn't get anything out of that station except feedback. The batteries were quite large. I'd say they were maybe 2.5 feet wide by about 4 feet deep by about maybe 4 feet high, each battery. And it's an awful long time ago what I can recall of those batteries. And they ran around the edge, the outer periphery of the wall. And God, stacked together, there was an awful lot of them. And you can just well imagine the weight that right there. that when that started to move, I don't think anything would stop that. So, yeah, it was a situation there that everything was marginal. You know, the stuff they put on the I-beams to protect against fire was not the right fire retardant. It blew off as soon as the planes hit. And all that plastics, I could say, and everything else that went on. The only thing I was scared of, my daughter worked right in that area a few blocks away. And I know she used to get off the train there at Cortlandt Street because she liked to walk by the apiary, the gardens there. And it was only 10, 15 minutes later when the first plane hit over.
Okay.
Hey, Dick, you ought to take a break now.
Yeah, stand by, you guys. That person we're hearing in the background with a lot of feedback was Eric. And Eric, give us a rough guess. We'll be in the standby mode for roughly how long? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
It shouldn't be more than 5 minutes.
Go for it, Eric.
All right, thanks, Dick. K2RIW, K2EJ.
We'll stand by until we hear you tell us to come on back on.
K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, we back in business, Eric?
Yes, you are.
Okay. So, you did what, a transmitter replacement?
Actually, about a week and change ago, we had, just before the hurricane. No, just after, I forget when. There was a synthesizer failure. I was wondering, you know, one of these problems with the phase lock loop was like, okay, where do you find the problem? I mean, you look everywhere, it's broken. It took a little while, it was a tough one.
Okay. Sounds like it's in good shape now. Alrighty. A whole bunch of other people wanted to make some comments about the World Trade Center and its collapse. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
KC2, QIQ with comments.
Glenn recognized? Who was the other person?
N2SZT with a comment.
N2, give that to me phonetically.